Hi there, listeners. You're listening to More Than a Whelan, episode 27, and I'm in heaven. My name is Sean M. Whelan, your host, and...
I'm Kat Canteri.
And I'm Justin Bernasconi.
Boom. Hi there, everybody. Welcome to More Than a Whelan, a podcast about creative writing written by me, but most importantly, inspired by you. Welcome to More Than a Whelan. We are coming at you not from sunny downtown Collingwood at Castaway Studios. Yes, for the second week in a row, we have gone mobile. And we are coming at you from Reservoir. How do they prefer to say it, Justin Bernasconi?
We say Keon Park.
That's very different pronunciation than I've heard
before.
Well,
it gets out of a lot of arguments when you say Keon Park.
Yeah.
And not many people know who it is, where that is.
No. I didn't know where it was until I went bowling there. Yeah.
You got lost by accident. Yeah. I got off the wrong train
stop. I planned to go there, but I just didn't really know where it was. But I looked it up on a map and I thought, actually, that's pretty close. We should go bowling.
Were you scared when you got out the train station?
I was. It was a very different world. But I do want to ask you and Kat Canteri, do you buy into that, the pronunciation of reservoir?
I believe that it's reservoir because the people that live here call it reservoir. It's kind of like if you go to Castlemaine where they call it Castlemaine. Yes. And if you go to Castlemaine and call it Castlemaine, they'll look at you and go
they do
externally and say,
yeah,
it's yeah. Castlemaine.
I say Castlemaine. They've never greased me.
Really?
Yeah. Well, and I say reservoir. And you know what? I know that I'm right because if you get on the train and you get to the train station at Reza, they say, we're arriving at Reservoir.
Do they say that?
They don't say Reservoir.
Right.
So.
Well, I think it should be Reservoir because it was named after a reservoir.
Yeah.
I know that for a fact. I did some history.
Yeah.
Because I got pulled up on calling it that. No, it's called Reservoir. Reservoir. Anyway, went on a tangent there. I was supposed to start the show with a poem. But, you know, that's how we roll here at More Than a Whelan because we are more than me. So I am going to start with a poem. I'm going to read this poem right now. Okay. It's called You Probably Think This Poem Is About You, and it probably is. Your mother told me that on the night you were born, a fully loaded semi-trailer crashed through your front fence and rolled over, spilling hundreds of fresh, ripe bananas across your lawn. I said to her, what do you think that meant? She said two ambulance officers down with broken limbs while trying to sprint through a minefield of comic relief to aid in your premature birth. Your father told me that as a teenager, you chewed gum like a horse on amphetamines, dressed like a blind aerobics instructor, and told anyone that would listen that bananas were Satan's handguns. He also told me that every night you didn't stay at home, he'd stand on the back porch and chain smoke, petrified that his daughter wasn't coming home anymore, and one night, you didn't. Your grandmother told me you used to compare the wrinkles on her hands to maps of mythical lands, and every time you'd visit her, you'd make up a different country for each hand. And sometimes the countries of her hands were at war, and you'd flail your grandmother's hands about in the air till she'd shout for her medication. But she didn't mind, because your grandmother told me you knew about the significance of being old, because you had been old before. The local Catholic priest told me you stormed into his church one day and demanded to know who put this fire into us. Which God was responsible? Was it yours? He was too afraid to admit that it was, so he sent you down the road to the synagogue and a mosque instead. Your drug dealer told me that he had to explain to you that he only sells illegal drugs and that chocolate was available pretty much anywhere. Your ex-lover told me you used to shout the names of each of the four Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles while you were having sex and have no memory of it afterwards. Your ex-lesbian lover told me that you used to shout the names of the 12 apostles while having sex with her, because sex with a woman took longer. Your housemates told me that one day a week you took a vow of silence and only communicated to the rest of the house through interpretive dance. They told me that compiling a shopping list on that day was an exhausting ordeal. Your best friend told me that you told me you loved me once. I said, I don't remember that. She said, because you told me you loved me through interpretive dance, I thought you were choking and tried to perform the Heimlich maneuver upon you. And you told me that I don't know anything about you. And you were right. But I'm learning.
Woo!
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, so there is a reason for me reading that poem, which is quite an old one for me, but it will be reissued on an amazing collection that's coming out in August called Solid Air. Australian, it's a collection of Australian and New Zealand spoken word, edited by David Stavanger, who was also one of my editors for my book, my last book, Tattooing the Surface of the Moon. I almost forgot the name of my own book. It was quite a while ago it came out. And Anne-Marie Te Wihu. They are the editors, and there's like over 100 performance poets on this collection, including Omar Musa, Maxine Benaba Clark, Taika Waititi, the amazing New Zealand director. He did Thor and Boy, and he's on there, which is incredible. Kwan from Regurgitator, Corny Barnett's on there. I'm really excited about being on this collection, and it's going to be, I think you can pre-order it now, but it will be issued officially on the 6th of August, 2019. So anyway, welcome to the show, Kat and JB. I'm in your kitchen. I feel very honoured to be here.
Well, you are very honoured to be here. We never ever let anybody pass the door. And really? Our dog has had a very strict screening.
I know.
Sort of
I'm looking
sniff.
At her now. She's
been sniffed out.
She's staring into my eyes. She's beautiful.
It's a very intense little dog.
So welcome to the show. So you are individually musicians, collectively musicians. Well, you were as a Stilson. So let's get some background on your musical history first. Why don't you go ahead and tell me, Kat?
Justin and I met in 2007
mm-hmm.
at the Old Bar in Melbourne, upstairs.
Yeah.
And it was very early days of the Stilsons back then. And it was just him and a bass player. And I just loved the songs. And we got along like a house on fire. And so I started playing with the band.
Oh, I see. So the Stilsons already existed when you met Justin.
Oh,
Not as that name.
Right,
I see. We were just jamming around, and it's very, very sketchy sort of stuff at that time. I can't remember what we were going as. I think we were just wanting to sort of think of lots of different names to get kind of gigs, but I think...
We'll just say it was the Stilsons.
Yeah,
but that was.
It was the bar open. It was a very, very sort of crazy time.
Oh, hang on. I think you might have said Old Bar. Actually, was it actually bar open?
Sorry, it was bar open.
Right,
bar open.
Because I was going to say, didn't everybody meet at bar open at one stage?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and not sober.
No, because I used to run a poetry gig at Bar Open
Did
too.
You?
But back around that time, actually, I think.
It was around about the Hugh McKinley was running a Wednesday night there every once a month, and he had us down there. And
right, yeah,
and then
yeah.
Then we had a residency at the Laundry, when it used to be called the Laundry on Johnson Street. And
yeah.
That's where Kat's audition was.
It was my audition. I was running late.
Yeah.
I was living in Northcote at the time with my parents, and obviously it's a pretty arduous tram journey from Northcote to Brunswick Street and Johnson Street, so I was late.
Yeah.
No excuses there. And yeah, rocked in late. And that was my first jam/audition with the band. I guess it kind of went from there. We sort of played around for a couple of years and started recording what was to become our debut record called Circus, which we recorded using my laptop and Mbox. out in my bedroom and
in my flat,
in Justin's flat.
Yeah.
And yeah, I guess that was just kind of, you know, early days of kind of grafting songs and learning how to be a group and stuff like that. And
doing things on the cheap.
Yeah.
Well, just doing things on a budget, you know, like we had no money. I was a student. I had no money. Justin had no money. So yeah, we're just doing whatever we could to make it work. And funny enough, you know, that record is still kind of, I think in terms of like online stuff, that's still, we still get, that's the thing that brings in the most revenue out of all the records. Ironically, I don't know how or why. It's definitely the most lo-fi of all our recordings. But there must be something endearing about it. Otherwise I've, you know, yeah. So, yeah, I guess, you know, went from 2007 to sort of last time we did a Stillson's record was 2013. That was our third record. And, you know, the band changed enormously in that time. We had, after we did our record Circus, we had Ben Franz, our dear friend, join the band on pedal steel. And, yeah, he was a really amazing influence on the group. And I think we were both definitely kind of, you know, looking at each other going, oh, man, we've really better write some really good songs and play really well because this guy's an incredible musician. And,
shout out to Ben Franz. He is an incredible musician, plays with The Waves and a million other different bands.
Many people.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, so, so then we did our second record called Ernest, which Ben recorded in our house in Thornbury.
Mm-hmm.
And then fast forward a few years later, we did our third record, which we recorded up in the studio called Applewood, which is owned by a bloke called Magoo, which is in Queensland, sort of outside Brisbane. And we went up there for a couple of weeks and recorded that record. And then following that, we sort of decided to make some solo records, I guess, you know, like, I mean, I think like any artist, you know, there's so many facets to everyone's creativity that it's hard if you've just got one creative outlet. Like I think most creative people need sort of multiple avenues for,
absolutely,
you know, for their self-expression and to feel, you know, satisfied. So, so sort of 2012 to 2014, we started sort of recording and writing our first solo records, Justin and I, and that's kind of what we've been doing since that time. I've put out three records and Justin's put out two. He's working on his third. And
is that through your own label?
Yeah,
Mountain King Music.
So did you start that?
Well, we kind of all started it. What had happened is that it's really born out of like most things out of necessity because we didn't really have a budget at all. There was no way in the world that we could pay for a publicist or a booking agent, or anything. We really didn't have a pot to piss in. So we were like, well, look, why don't we just organize something ourselves and. Ben was already producing everything and doing, all the recording and bringing all his beautiful gear in from Perth to record us. And we're like, well, we're contributing songs, but be nice to be able to contribute something else. And, you know, when you put that amount of investment into, you know, your time and your love into a project, you do want to make sure that it kind of has the best sort of chance off the block. So we formed this thing called Mountain King Music. I drew a logo, just had an email address. That was it.
Yeah.
And then we just started contacting people. Kat started organizing all the tours, doing all the booking. And I started to take care of things like press releases, biographies, contacting radio stations, contacting newspapers and things like that. And it was, at the time, it was quite sort of terrifying because, you know, you're just sort of making it up as you go along and you feel like you're going to get found out at any time that you're a complete imposter, which...
Right, because you're doing it all yourself.
You're doing it all yourself and you feel quite vulnerable because you, you have to sort of, you really have, you don't lie, but you, you don't, the only way you can get through is by not trying to bullshit anybody and just say, well, look, this is what it is.
Mm.
It's just, it's a band, you know, we think we make, you know, pretty good sort of interpretation of Americana. What do you think? And that's as far as it goes. It's just getting it to the people, that, making sure that it gets in their hands. That's all you can do.
Well, that's right. And look, you know, there's a lot to complain about in this current musical climate, I guess, in that, you know, people in the streaming musical climate. But one of the things I do love about it is that it is possible to do it all on your own. You don't, you know, back in the day, you used to go have to go through gatekeepers. You didn't get a record release unless a label chose you to get that record release. But everyone can do it right from the very ground roots, from recording it to distributing it to getting it out there. I mean, it's exhausting and it's very hard work, but it is possible to do it all on your own these days.
I mean, I think it's great. I think obviously it comes with, you know, the climate of the industry has changed and there's a lot of things that are really different. But I think on the whole, I think it's a great thing, you know, because people who would never be able to have their music heard can do it now.
Absolutely.
And I think that it creates more of an equal platform, I suppose. I mean, I know a lot of people probably have, you know, differing opinions, but that's cool. But, I think, you know, it was really, like Justin said, born out of necessity. I mean, I couldn't call anyone on the phone when I started booking our gigs. And back then you pretty much book most things by calling people on the phone. I had so much anxiety. Like I never called anybody.
Wow.
No.
It really would make you anxious to do
that.
Yeah,
like I just never, you know, I didn't get a phone until, like, you know, I went to uni. I didn't have one in high school and I wasn't ever part of that. I don't know. He'll attest to the fact that I was just atrocious with my phone back then. Like he used to call and text me and I just wouldn't get back to him for days.
Wow.
You know, and so, yeah.
Used to?
Yeah. You know, when I first started booking gigs, like it was so overwhelming for me, like the level of anxiety. I just didn't know what to say and, you know, and how to say it and just to speak confidently and learn how to communicate, I guess, in
just
a really clear and efficient way.
It's all the sell and spin,
Yeah, but I think sometimes, you know, like, you know, in a lot of creative industries, it's often about, you know, speaking to somebody and feeling like they're being real and they're being like getting along with people, you know, liking somebody when you speak to them on the phone, when you meet them at a gig, you know, all that stuff. It's just that really, I don't know. It's that it. I guess it's feeling like you get a genuine sense of people, you know, and so many. I feel like so many opportunities from music for me just came from people kind of chatting to me and going, "Oh yeah, she seems cool. What, like, we'll give her a go."
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah. So it is really hard selling yourself. I know people who are really, really good at selling, who are great artists, who are great at selling other artists, but find it very hard to talk about their own work. Which is what you're doing when you're doing it all on your own and managing yourself and booking your own gigs and stuff. And because you're already coming from behind the eight ball, because you actually do, whether it's right or wrong, you sort of lose some credibility stakes, I guess, when you're pitching yourself to venues when you're doing it yourself rather than having a booking agent doing that. So you got to push against that as well. And it's all about confidence, I guess. What do you think, JB?
Well, you definitely have to be prepared and you have to be prepared for the knocks. And I think one of the things is that I don't think you really have when I've approached people, I haven't tried to bullshit anybody. I just sort of, you know, just sell it what it is. It's just a group that we're just trying to to do some new music and we're out touring. Can you give us a go? Can you listen to it? And, you know, there's been quite a few times where people come back and they've not realised that I was, you know, the artist giving it to them and they just paid out on the band and, you know, just said it was really not up to much, not even as good as mediocre. And this is like on Radio National. And then you might have some journalists say, you know, really give it a stinker of a view. And the thing is that you have to bear in mind every time you call up somebody or get an email back from somebody that you're the one asking them for their opinion. And if you don't like their opinion, you just got to suck it up.
Yeah.
And you might be, true. You might be sitting there punching the cushion on the couch for maybe 10 minutes afterwards, or your ass might be hanging for 2 weeks, but you still got to suck it up. And one of the harder things, or the things that I found that made it sustainable for me, is not to react.
Yeah.
As soon as I'd react, I'd feel doubly worse. And I think what made things a lot easier for me is I did publicity for Jed Rowe and Alison Ferrier, and I definitely found it a lot easier to help them out and to do their publicity. And I actually found that I actually reacted a little bit more because and defended them a bit more because I felt I could.
Yes. Yeah.
But
yeah.
When it was us, I was like, oh, you don't like it. Oh, you think it's shit. Okay, yeah. Fair enough.
Yeah.
And it was actually more healthy not to react and not to try and get too emotionally involved in doing stuff. And I guess that's one of the reasons why a really good press release comes in handy, because it just all it's doing is just, you know, can you give it a listen or not? You're not asking them to like it. You never ask anybody to like it.
Yeah.
Because it's always going to get somebody's back up. Nobody likes to be told what they like. And and it was a very, very interesting time.
Well, when you're talking about a booker or something like that, they don't necessarily have to like it anyway. It's just a matter of whether it fits what goes on at their venue or what goes on at their label. They don't have to personally like it. That's almost
irrelevant.
Whether
they want to commit time to checking it out.
Yeah, exactly. Now, I want to do a little bit of a jump in time here, actually, and I want to go way back in the Wayback Machine and find out how both of you first wanted to become musicians. Kat, walk me through it.
Oh, that's a good question. I think the primary school I went to had a really amazing school choir.
Yeah.
Run by this lady called Therese Virtue, who does, you know, a myriad of amazing musical projects. She's probably best known for her work with the Boite, World Music Cafe. And her son went to my primary school and she was the choir director. And she had this amazing, amazing school choir. We sung all these folk songs from all around the world in different languages. I really loved it. I guess probably the earliest thing I can remember about liking music was when I was in prep and my school was putting on a production of Aladdin.
Wow.
And I like really, really, really wanted to be in it. And I think, I might have auditioned and didn't get a part or whatever. And then later in primary school, some of my really close friends were in the Australian Girls Choir and they're really amazing singers. And there was a production that was put on at the school. One of my friends, Jack Grant, his mother wrote it. It was a play called Aqua Profonda. It was about the community saving the Fitzroy Pool. My school put on this play at Fitzroy Town Hall. Was it Fitzroy? No, it was Collingwood Town Hall. And it was amazing. But I didn't make it into the main cast of that because I just, I guess wasn't up to it at that time. I always really loved music and kind of fell in love with, pop music when I was around 10, 11 years old was sort of bugging my parents to let me learn the drums for like 2 years. And they kind of finally agreed when I started high school. My father actually took me down to the music swap shop in Carlton upon a recommendation of a friend of ours' family who was a musician, because my dad was trying to work out, you know, we didn't have a lot of money, and so he was kind of working out, well, you know, we're going to have to buy her a drum kit, like, you know, we want to make sure that she's going to stick to it, but also possibly that she's got some aptitude. So they took me down to the music swap shop, and there was a guy down there who was like a friend of a friend of a friend who played drums, and my dad took me down there and he was like, talked to this guy and was like, hey, my daughter wants to learn drums, and kind of worded him up on the situation. So he took me out to one of the back rooms and like did these like different like for maybe 10 minutes of different drum exercises, just tapping on my legs and, you know, using not actually playing anything but just sort of having a tap, to try and work out whether I had any kind of
some inherent rhythm.
Pretty much, yeah. And that was the first time I went to the swap shop when I was about, I must have been 11. So yeah, I don't know, but kind of, I guess going back, you know, to when I was really little, I remember catching up with my grade one teacher a few years ago, and she goes, "Oh, you know, you always, whenever you were in class, you always used to just like be singing or like doing a little, like you'd go from one end of the room to the other and you'd just be singing and doing a little dance." And, you know, I guess I probably sound like a bit of a free spirit. So, yeah, that was kind of nice to hear that story because I didn't know that about myself when I was six. So I have no memory of it. So
really? Yeah.
But, yeah, so, yeah, I started learning drums at high school and really loved it. But I guess I always wanted to, there's something within me that was like, oh, I want to write songs and I really wanted to sing, but I was, you know, I was really shy. I'd kind of been burnt at primary school when I was, you know, when I was five, I was in prep and there were these girls in my class. I must've been singing at my table and they turned around to me and they said, "Can you shut up? You're not very good at singing, you know."
It only takes one little burn like that, it can affect you for quite a long time, can't it?
Totally. Yeah, totally. And it really did. And so, and I guess that coupled with these experiences of, you know, being in sort of later primary school and my close friends, you know, being in the Australian Girls Choir and being amazing singers, I just kind of, I guess, just like kind of, you know, sunk into the background very much. And so it kind of took, you know, I guess learning drums at high school and then learning to play guitar and starting to learn how to write songs, you know, and I was doing it really quietly at home over a number of years, like just trying to learn to write a song. And then this thing happened when I was in year 12, I entered a song in the Darabin songwriting competition and I won. And then the head of music at my high school found out and then somehow they got me to sing. I sung a song at our graduation ceremony and no one knew that I could sing or play guitar, so everyone was just like, "What? Oh,
wow, that's a real like high school movie moment."
It was actually
when the girl that everyone thinks she can't sing, and then she just comes out and she nails it.
That was pretty much what happened.
Love it, love it. And you're giving like two fingers up to all those bitches. that's a great little origin story. Okay, so JB, take me through your origin story, so to speak. Where'd you grow up and how did music first inflict itself upon you?
That's a good question. Growing up in rural Cambridgeshire, it was there's not a lot going on there. In the UK, I grew up in a small little village called Warboys, which is around about 40 minutes drive from Cambridge, going up the A1.
Yeah.
And it was very flat sort of land, very prone to flooding. 500 years ago, they used to hang witches in the village And so when I went to school at the Ramsey Abbey, we had like witches on as our school badge.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, they wore it with pride, the witches thing. So.
Oh, that's cool. I like that.
It's pretty cool. Yeah. It's a bit like the actual school looked like Hogwarts, right, but it was anything, but right. It was pretty basic in the day. And but my father was a mechanic and he loved listening to records at the weekends. He just loved it. So he used to listen to, you know, stuff that was going on, I guess, in his heyday, which was like Pink Floyd.
Yeah.
Tubular Bells, Mike Oldfield.
Yeah.
Bad Company. He was like the rock, early Genesis. Well, Genesis at any period, but he loved the early stuff.
And he wasn't a musician, but just a music lover.
Well, he actually, in the early 70s, he used to tune up racing engines when he lived in London. He was from New Zealand. He emigrated to the UK in the early 70s.
Oh, I see, right.
So he used to tune up racing engines. Yeah, so I think he had a very good ear for doing that because you have to do all sorts of things to tune racing engines, you know. Right. Everything has to be literally in harmony. And
that's really cool. I've never thought of that as a musical process before, but it very much is, isn't it?
It is. And we used to sort of go out to see racing car. You know, my older brother used to race cars, and you used to do different things like cutting the exhaust to a certain length to make sure that it was in tune with the rest of the engine. It had to be cut at the right frequency.
Yeah, right.
And so you have all these sort of things that if an engine is not in, in harmony, then it, when it's revving at such high revs, it will rattle itself to bits.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so, so I grew up with all that sort of stuff, and it was pretty cool. But for some reason, I was bugging my parents to want to learn how to play the guitar at the age of 9. I have no idea why. And I remember when the first day I got my guitar, I took it to school because one of the teachers there did group lessons, and I came back saying I didn't want to have lessons off the teacher because I didn't like the way he played the guitar.
Right.
So I was pretty picky at age 9. And then my best friend's father played classical guitar, and he played in an orchestra. He played like double bass. So he gave me lessons for about 6 months to a year. And then one day I remember rocking up to his house for a guitar lesson, and there are all these seats in the living room. And I was like, oh, that's a bit odd. And there are all these people sitting in the seats, and there was a seat in the corner. And I had no idea what was going on. I said, oh, can you sit on that seat right in the corner there? And it had a music stand and my little footstool, you know, for me to sit in the classical position. And they just asked me to play all these songs or these tunes that he had taught me. And I had no idea what was going on. And everybody was clapping after I was finishing each tune. So I had no idea that was my first gig. But I remember his eldest son coming up and sort of give me a bit of a punch because he was learning guitar and he was getting a bit shitty about it.
So that was my best thing. That you don't know that it's your first gig. It takes out that nerve factor.
Yeah, and then
you're just being told to sit there and play.
That's right. Yeah. And then after that, I was like, I don't want to do classical anymore. And I want to learn AC/DC because I just heard a whole lot of Rosie. And he said, listen, I don't know anything about rock music, but the best thing I can do is Simon and Garfunkel. And I was like, I went to my dad, who the hell is that? And my dad goes, oh, no, they're really good. No, learn that. So I started to learn like The Boxer, Mrs. Robinson, yeah. I'm a Rock, Celia, yeah. All these sort of stuff, you know. Yeah. And then it just blew, you know, age 9, 10, it just blew my mind. The lyrics were just so, you know, conjured up all this amazing imagery. And then I was hooked on folk music. So I had this sort of weird juxtaposition of folk music, AC/DC and classical.
Love it. Love it. That's a great combination. And so then what was your first band?
Well, I had my first band. It must have been no more than about 13, 14. And I think the two songs that we learnt how to play was Running Free by Iron Maiden off their first album and Touch Too Much by AC/DC. And all we knew were those two songs. And we had a drummer in the group that lived down next to the quarry because they used to have an old bricks works and had this huge, great big quarry, sort of a great big sort of open cut sort of hole just outside the village, and it was full of water. And my friend had a house there, or he lived with his parents there. And so we'd go around to his house and all we'd do is play two songs for hours and hours and hours. And we recorded onto cassette tape. It was fantastic.
Love it, love it. And then when did you make your way to Australia?
Well, I came here 15 years ago, and I mean, after being living out in the village to my early 20s, I moved to London, and London was a lot of fun, but it's a very overwhelming city. And,
yes, indeed.
It can be a very, very tough city, and it was great fun, but I actually got a little bit lost there. And then my father's family is from Auckland, so, you know, I thought I'd come over and visit them and see how they're going. And everybody, even in London, raved about how good the music scene was in Melbourne. So I was really keen to get here to see what it was all about. And when I got here, you know, they really weren't wrong. I mean, you have everything here. You've got rock music, country music, blues, jazz, Greek music. You've got everything here. And so, and it's respected, you know, and so coming here was just blew my mind. So I just literally ripped up my ticket and stayed.
Right. Wow. Wow, Melbourne's reputation for being the music capital of the country really convinced you. Of the world, yes.
Of the world,
yeah. It's definitely, I don't know the statistics exactly, but I know that we definitely have one of the highest amount of venues and stuff per capita and stuff like that. And There's so many like record shops. There's an insane amount of record shops in this town. I think we've got one of the highest cap per capita of those as well. And so many gigs. I mean, Melbourne's blessing can also be its curse in a way, in that, yes, like every night of the week, almost any time of the day, you can go out and see absolute top quality, world quality musicians perform. But because there is so much, sometimes, you know, people will play to like nobody, and not as a reflection of their standard of music or their professionalism. It's just because it's a very, very competitive market in Melbourne.
But that happens everywhere. I mean, for instance, going to Cambridge every weekend, I used to see some of the world's best acts come and play at the Cambridge Folk Club every Friday. And those, I can tell you, those rooms weren't always full.
Yeah.
There was sometimes just a handful of people there. There could be maybe 20, 30 people there. At the best, you'd have maybe 50 to 60 people. And we're talking like amazing acts.
Yeah.
And moving to London, it was the same thing. You'd look in Time Out. That was the magazine then, and you'd just go, what is on tonight? And there's this amazing array of music going for cheap too. You know, it's like for 10, 20 pounds, you could go and see Herbie Hancock play somewhere, and then you could go to the jazz cafe and see an international act for not very much money. And those rooms wouldn't always be full either.
Yeah.
So it's the same sort of... And the music scene was actually quite, it was when I left, it was actually getting quite bad, the local scene, because what ended up happening was venues ended up asking for deposits from artists. And we're talking like £100, which was probably a couple of hundred dollars. And that was 15 years ago. And if you didn't bring a certain amount of people, then you lost your deposit for the venue.
Wow, I had not heard of that before. Yeah. Does that happen in Melbourne?
I'm not sure if it's happened in Melbourne, but you do have higher fees for venues.
Sure, sure.
But in London, it was getting like that, very mercenary, and you know, and it wasn't a particularly inspiring time for, you know. So Melbourne is really good.
Oh yeah, very 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 passionate city about its music, and of all. Every kind of niche music you can think of is represented in some shape or form in Melbourne, which is so wonderful. Now, I also want to touch on another subject with you, because you are both very accomplished musicians, but you're also partners. You live together, you perform together, and I just want to know about the mechanics of that, because I know quite a few. Partners in Melbourne who perform together as well. It means you're living, eating, breathing music like 24/7, you know. Does that ever get, I don't know what the question is, you know, I'm trying to ask. yeah, I guess so.
It's a great question. I think, you know, we've been together for 10 years this year, and
congratulations.
Thank you very much. And I guess things have evolved, as any relationship does, pretty significantly in that time. I think, you know, when we first got together as a couple, we'd been playing music together for 2 years. We were best mates. So we'd seen, you know, almost 3 years. And so we'd sort of, you know, seen the best and the worst of each other, playing a band together and being, you know, Justin was my best friend, and like best friends, you know, sometimes get really jack of each other and, you know, that kind of thing. And, but when we first got together, we moved into a house, together in Thornbury. And at that time we were really, all of our energy was going into our band, the Stilsons. We were just, we got a new bass player in the band. We were rehearsing literally every day, writing, demoing songs. You know, that was sort of the time when I started booking gigs for the band, and Justin started, you know, we started doing the whole Mountain King music thing. So all of our kind of energy was going into the group. And I think once that kind of got, once that got established, and I think we started to work on our own individual projects, I think things changed. I guess when we lived in Thornbury for 5 years, and then we moved out to Reservoir, and I think moving sort of a little bit further out away from kind of the, you know, center of the action. You know, we moved away from the bars, away from the music venues. I guess we started to kind of, I guess, I don't know how to describe it. I guess
compartmentalize things.
I guess so. I think that we realized that we probably needed to, we put up a few boundaries because we'd been with each other, because we'd been working so hard on the band for so many years, and it was, I think we, you know, we didn't really have any kind of guidelines about when we spoke about creative stuff. So, you know, like you're in bed, you're about to literally fall asleep, and the other person goes, oh, I just had this great idea for a song. And then all of a sudden you're wired because you started talking about creative stuff. So I think because we started playing separately, we probably, I guess, tried to give each other a bit more space, I suppose. And I mean, I know sometimes I could be a bit overbearing, like if Justin had a song idea or whatever, I might kind of go, oh, and you could do this and you could do this and you could do this.
Never
and,
my darling.
And he'd be like, well, hang on, maybe I want some personal space to work out what the song does without you.
Yeah.
Do you
both have different processes when it comes to writing songs?
Well, I don't think there's any really one process to writing a song for anybody that I know. I think, I mean, it's interesting sort of talking about songwriting, because I think sometimes, you know, you can work at a song for years, you know, and then another song can pop out within 5 minutes. I think what I think a lot of people assume that we write songs together all the time, and that's not strictly true. I mean, what we try to do is give each other a lot of space. I mean, I think one of the things is that we, how we try and keep ourselves sane amongst sort of doing work and having a relationship and being creative is that we try to have quite a lot of silence in our house. We don't own a TV.
I don't.
No, we don't. We try to. The biggest addiction that we have is the screens, you know, like social media, like anybody.
As we all do, yes.
And so, for instance, you know, sometimes we just, you know, I mean, if I go and sit in my room and I have my little, the room that I like to be in is, I like to have a small room. Yeah. And I feel creative in a small room. If I'm in a big space, something loses it for me.
Yeah.
And so Kat likes to have a big space. And so she feels creative upstairs. I'm downstairs in my little sort of cave. And I feel comfortable in there. And we generally know not to infringe on each other unless we're asked. And I think that's one of the boundaries that you kind of have, because sometimes, you know, you just want to work stuff out on your own. You kind of know what you want, and when if you come up to a block, you sort of kind of, that's when you sort of go, well, look, what do you think, give me your idea. And generally they've heard the song, you know, Kat would have heard one of my tunes around about 100 times in 2 weeks. She was like, yeah, I know that song better, that tune better than you. And I go, what do you reckon, what's not working? And she might go, you've got too much in there, or, you know, stuff like that. And we'll generally, because we've been doing it for 10 years, we'll generally ask for specifics with the song. It's like, what do you reckon to this lyric? What do you reckon to this arrangement? Rather than, you know, what do you reckon it as a whole? Because sometimes that can be, you can ask for something you didn't want to hear.
So I guess with experience comes shorthand for workshopping
that sort of
stuff.
Yeah, just communicating what you want. And you know, and then coming back to sort of, you know, how this sort of stuff works as a couple, and, you know, it does have its ups and downs. Sometimes, you know, you really need to, you know, have a bit, quite a bit of space, and sometimes it's amazing being around each other. But what I think the most important thing is to have something to compare to. And when we used to be on tour with other musicians that used to be tour with us, with the Stilsons, and even on Kat's group, and when I was doing my solo stuff, and I'd have different musicians tour with me, and I'd be on the phone all the time to their partner, and we'd be stopping at fuel stations, and they'd sort of go off for a quiet moment somewhere and call up their partner, and they wouldn't see them for 2 or 3 weeks, whereas I'd be touring with my partner for, you know, 2 weeks. And yeah, sure, sometimes you're gonna get a bit pissed off with each other once in a while, but generally it's pretty good. You're having all these amazing experiences with each other and you're sharing it, and you can always reflect and go, hey, do you remember that time in whatever, Port Macquarie, or do you remember those bogans down in wherever, and that sort of stuff, or when we jumped, you know, we went to the beach and different things. So it's pretty good.
Yeah. There's I'm not going to name any names, but you'll probably know who I'm talking about. But there's a couple who were working together in a band in Melbourne, and they had a bit of a volatile relationship. And then I remember they broke up, but then they were still in the band together. And I just thought, fuck, that would be hard.
Oh, yeah.
That'd be pretty hard, wouldn't it? I think you just have to just like put your head down and like, this is what I'm doing. I'm in this band. I'm doing it. But do you think that would be like pretty difficult?
Well, we've talked about having those difficulties, because sometimes it's, you know, you do, you go through your rough spots and stuff. And when you're going through your rough spots, you got to get on stage and pretend you're not having a rough spot.
Yeah.
And plus you got crew around you, and you just got to be professional, and plus another thing, you have to be a bit protective of yourself. I think Kat and I sometimes we've had a talk about stuff when it goes, well, what's important to us, music or the relationship? And I think if you're choosing music over your relationship, then you're probably not in the right relationship.
That's interesting.
Sometimes it's or maybe you're not sort of choosing the right coping mechanisms to communicate in that relationship, and maybe the relationship's great and you're suited to each other, but you just don't have the tools to be able to deal with some of those rough times and
the pressure.
Yeah, it is a lot of pressure getting on stage. There is a lot of like what we'd call, or this term that we heard, social masking, where you have to get on stage and you can't always be yourself, even though you try to. You don't want to sort of bullshit anybody, but you got to get on there, and you could be going through some sort of personal nightmare.
Yeah.
And you can see your partner going through a personal nightmare and having a, maybe, you know, you could be going through some breakdown, and then you got to get up on stage and play, and then you get off and you just like, get me out of here. And yeah. But you can't sort of do that. You know, I mean, we played at the year that I played at Port Ferry, I had chronic fatigue. And literally I was getting on the stage and Kat was packing up all my stuff afterwards, and I was just coming off the stage. I couldn't even, you know, I found it very difficult to perform. And we were just get me out of here, get me back to the billet. I don't have the strength to lead. I don't have the strength to do anything. And Kat was basically shifting me around, but anybody who was there at that time would have no idea.
Yeah.
You know, because we didn't want them to know.
No. And it's interesting what you said at the start, because you do still want to be authentic, and you are being authentic as a musician, but you can't show it. We don't need to show every face of authenticity. So you don't need to show that face of illness or inner conflict. But you can still be authentic about who you are as a musician. Yeah.
Yeah. I think also sometimes even the musicians that are around you, they're very close to you, and some, you know, they're very close friends. Sometimes you can't even let too much out to them, because it will affect them when you're performing, because they will have concern for you. And that's a nice thing, but it can also be
counterproductive.
It can be, sometimes it can be counterproductive. You know, you don't want your friends who are on stage with you to feel anything else but the music when you're on there, you know. You just want to be getting up there and going, okay, this is the time where we're flying, you know, let's have a good time on stage, not sort of, but it's a tricky one.
Because, I'm not a musician, I think one day I will be. I've always wanted to be. But
singer.
maybe a singer or a rock star or both.
Maracas.
Maracas.
Bez.
That guy can make a living out of it. Surely I can. But I'll have to shift it up, because then they'll just say you're just being Bez. I have to choose a different.
Not if you wear shirts like that. You'll be more than Bez.
Instrument that I can shake around. I don't know. But now I've lost my train of thought. Oh, yeah, that's what I was going to say. I am always fascinated by watching a band in full flight and that just that silent communication between you.
It's like a pack.
Yeah. It's pack. It's really quite astounding to watch. And sometimes you mean it's
the,
not.
Are you talking about the glares of shame when you hit a bum note?
Well, that's the other thing I find fascinating. Sometimes it's not even through eye contact. It's just through this feeling of each other's energy on stage. It's almost this tangible chemistry between musicians. And when you see it in a band, you're just going in full flight and just really nailing it. And I'm not talking about like speed of music, just a band. It's just in perfect synchronicity. It's really, and that can be two people, that can be four people, six people, but it's really, it's really something quite stunning to watch.
It is, but it's great to be a part of it when it's, you know, and sometimes you never know when you're playing well. Sometimes it's really interesting, you know, you can sort of, we recorded different gigs when we'd gone. You know, we'd go and play. We go sometimes when you're on the road for maybe 2 weeks. You go, let's record it because we really feel like we're on fire. And then we record it. And sometimes you think, oh, that was a really really crap gig. And you listen back, and you go, actually, it was really good because we're really trying. And then a gig where we feel like we're flying, and you know, and it's everything's really easy. You listen back to it, and go, actually, it's a bit loose.
Right, so that's interesting.
The perceptions can be interesting. I would say. I wouldn't say that, you know, and look, somebody else could listen to that recording and go, wow, that's, I love it. I love the looseness of it. And somebody else could be, oh, no, I prefer that one. But it's all perception. That's the wonderful thing about music.
It's true.
It depends what you're listening for too, I suppose. You know, like you can be on stage and you can be really concerned with, you know, your vocal delivery or your vocal tone or your guitar tone or just like nailing a particular guitar solo, or you might be, you know, listening to the tempo of the song and it might be too fast or too slow. So you're sitting there playing going, oh, the groove isn't quite right. And you're preoccupied with these other things. Whereas somebody who's just receiving the music and listening is having a completely different experience to you. So
absolutely.
It's really interesting. You know, I do know what Justin's talking about. There are some, these one gig in particular going back many years where we recorded both sets of the gig. It was a two set a gig. And the first set, I remember we just thought, oh, we're not, it just felt like,
give up now.
It just felt like really like, it just felt like so much effort. And the second set, we like, it was, we just killed it. It was amazing. Yeah. And listen back to it. And the second set was just, we were just thrashing all over the shop. Right. It was really messy.
Shouting instead of singing.
You know, and the first set was just like, sounded incredible. We were performing so well, but it didn't feel like it at the time, you know.
Right, yeah, so, I find that as a performer too, and as either performing my poetry or even when I do weddings too, sometimes I feel like maybe I just wasn't nailing it for whatever reason, but then I'll come off and then I'll just get so many compliments and they're like, oh, you're just right on top of that. And I think, oh, I didn't feel like that. But often that is when I'm – it doesn't feel like that because you are thinking about it.
Mm.
And, you know, the take-home message here is don't think. Just do it.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. So now that we've been talking about all this musical stuff, I'd really like to hear you play a little bit of music yourself.
A songbird outside sings my melody, and rhymes makes my song sound complete. Shakes my head and moves my feet. Our lives move so fast and our heart moves so slow. One wheel on that verge, hitting off the road. Need a speed camera on my life. Speed camera on my life. My songbird's in a coma. Father takes a picture. Photo's a gift. When she wakes up, she'll see. You can have all your money, don't have your health. You won't be worried about your piggy bank wealth. Get a speed camera on your life. 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 Staring at the wall, going nowhere fast. You flick through a family album, two decades have gone past. Look at the changes, that's what truly lasts. Be careful what you reach for, it might be your last. Get a speed camera on your life. Speed camera on your life. Speed camera on your life. Speed camera on your life, alright.
Right, thank you so much for that.
No problem, JB. Pleasure.
So I'm also going to get you to do a cover for our Wheelin' and Stealin' section. Wheelin' and Stealin' is a segment of my show where I and my guests will perform works from other people. And so, but what I'd like you to do, because sometimes I hear covers, it's quite a weird thing. I don't know if you find this. Sometimes I hear a cover and I think, oh my God, I know that song. But just the fact that it's been performed by someone else, sometimes it takes me ages to remember who it is. And then when I do know, I was like, oh, you idiot. Of course it was that. But it can put it into a very different realm. So I'm going to get you to do the cover first and then tell me about it afterwards. So go for it.
I drove her to the station with a suitcase in my hand, and I drove her to the station with a suitcase in my hand. Well, it's hard to tell, hard to tell, when all your love's in vain. The train rolled up through the station, and I looked her in the eye. And a train rolled up through the station, and I looked her in the eye. Well, I'm so lonesome, I could not help but cry. My love's in vain. The train has left the station, two lights on behind. And the train has left the station, two lights on behind. Red light is my mind, all my love's in vain. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much, JB. What'd you choose that particular song?
Well, that I rarely play that tune, but I used to play it all the time when I was used to go to the frequent the Cambridge Folk Club.
Ah, yes, yeah.
And it was really I had a band when I was a teenager. You know, it's like you have all your hopes and dreams put into the your first proper band where you're going out and playing in proper venues and gigs, and then that split up, and I had no idea what to do. And so I started to play folk music, and I was finding it really difficult trying to find, I guess, somebody that I could really relate to. And then I remember reading about Robert Johnson, and I remember getting a CD of Robert Johnson, and I remember I had all these expectations about what it could sound like, and when I put it on, I was really shocked that it had this really high, eerie voice and this really crazy energy, and it was so eclectic too. It had blues there and ragtime, bottleneck slide, and this timing would be wild, and it sounded like somebody possessed, you know. And
yes, I had the same experience actually, in that I knew who Robert Johnson was before I heard him, because I worked in record shops for quite a long time, and I don't know, I'd read books on music and I'd keep hearing, because blues wasn't really my thing at the time, but I kept hearing about this Robert Johnson, legendary figure, you know, and I thought, oh, well, I've got to listen to it. There was this double CD box set that came out, a Columbia box set.
Yeah, the complete recordings or something, so 27 thought, recordings.
That's the one. I thought, I've got to, and it wasn't, I don't know what I expected, but it was a lot more, I can't even describe it. It was kind of like this kind of dark magic sound about it. Yeah, yeah.
That was right. It was like peering into the night.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And I didn't know what to think. I mean, I didn't know whether I liked it or not, but it was something that was gripping about it. And it was almost like you had to crack the code with it. You had to listen to it and listen to it. And then all of a sudden you started to get into the nuances. And then when you heard the stories. But I used to play that tune a lot when I used to go to the Cambridge Folk Club, and used to go to the Ely Folk Club, and a lot of the folk clubs in the Fens where I grew up, and occasionally I do a lot of I used to do a lot of sort of corporate gigs, because I was like, you know, I was only sort of 20, 21, and I was cutting my teeth playing in cover bands and playing weddings, and they used to have a lot of American air bases out there, because it was, you know, that was the area for American air bases. So I used to go and play country music on American air bases. So at night, some of the music I really loved, with the old Hank Williams stuff, but then we would play all the new country stuff at the time, which was Garth Brooks, and I used to hate that sort of stuff at the time.
Yeah.
And which is now the norm now with country music, but I used to put on Robert Johnson. As soon as I got in the car, I'd put on Robert Johnson. It would get me back to where I could relate to myself.
Yeah, get you back into the core. Cleanse yourself of that achy, breaky heart.
It would, and it's just eerie. This one voice, it wouldn't be anything else there. It would just be a voice. He didn't have anybody accompany him. He was just playing to himself in a hotel room somewhere. Mm, yeah. And listening to that sort of for a 40-minute drive back home at like 1 o'clock in the morning in the countryside, it was a really special time for me. So every time I play that tune, it kind of puts me back into that space where I was in the country, you know, when I was a young kid living at home.
I dig that. I dig that. That's a really good story. Thank you. So let's get the wonderful Kat Kanteri in front of a microphone with a musical instrument. I should mention, I don't know if I did mention that Kat plays both guitar and drums. I don't know if she's going to do that at the same time. Probably not. But she will play one instrument or another. Okay, welcome to the kitchen table, Kat Kanteri. You're going to play an original song for us first? Or are you going to do a cover first?
I'm going to play an original song first.
Beautiful. Tell me about it. Well, so let's start the title.
This one, it's called Stand Up and Be My Man.
Oh, I like that.
And I think the title kind of says everything about the song.
Yeah. Well, that's all you need to say.
Speaks for itself.
Introduction. Thank you.
No worries.
Take it away.
Tried so hard to make you stand up and be my man, but every day turns out the same. You turn your head and look the other way. We rarely see eye to eye. I don't know to fight your kind of fights, always in the wrong, and you can't see the things you hold dearer than me. The day I said I'm leaving, I'm leaving, I'm leaving, I'm leaving. Stand up and be my man. Why won't you see the words written on the wall? I don't love you.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much. Devastating end to that song.
Toad's devastated.
I actually ran into you sort of accidentally in Castlemaine. I should know that. At the Bridge Hotel. Shout out to Jeremy and Patty. And you were laying down some sick guitar leads. You were like, it was like something you were saying, like you were something that was something you were doing, like a new thing that you're trying to get out and do more, like guitar.
Yeah, stuff. Yeah. Like that was the first. I normally play either solo or as a 4-piece band with Justin playing electric guitar. And I guess over the last couple of years, I started to play lead guitar in my band, which has been really fun. But yeah, that gig you saw at the Bridge was the first gig I did as a three piece, so drums, right, bass, guitar.
Yeah.
And the reason I decided to do that was because when you play as a three piece, like a power trio, you really have to cover all of the guitar parts yourself. I guess my vision is to take all the glory with the singing,
yeah,
and the guitar playing. And I felt like, you know, obviously Justin's, you know, such an incredible guitarist, and having him there as a, you know, my partner as a, you know, musical resources is amazing, but it's really easy to lean on that. You know,
right,
what I mean?
I
like,
see, yeah,
you know, sometimes you can practice stuff at home heaps, but you get to a gig and you're like, people would rather hear him play a solo. I'll let him take it. Like, you can sort of, it's almost, I think, a little bit what can happen to musicians when they know a lot of covers. It's really easy to have a moment of low self-confidence at a gig and just play a cover rather than your own song.
Yes.
And so I think, that gig, like I was saying, the gig that you saw me play at Castlemaine at the Bridge was the first trio gig I'd done. So I guess it was just a way of me forcing myself into a musical situation where I had to, where I had to take full responsibility for lead duties and for, I guess, you know, all of the, I guess it was also about me sort of just going, okay, I really want to cover everything and I really want to have an excuse to make myself step up to the plate. You know, it's just a very different thing playing with another guitarist. It changes things for the drummer and the bass player as well. When you are playing in a trio format, it can, you know, I guess it just means that everything that you do matters a little bit more, because there is just having that one less person in the band, everyone's taking up more sonic space. So everything that you do, yeah, matters more and has a bigger impact, I think. That's been really fun. And since then I've played a couple of played a few more sort of trio gigs.
I was going to ask you that. So you've done some more trio gigs since then.
I played at Malden Folk Festival. Festival with the trio, which was really, really fun, and like just had the best time. I was on at the I'm not even sure what the stage is called. It's like their big sort of it's like a big old town hall.
Yeah.
And played two nights there and just like had the best time. Played all my sort of like more kind of like lyric centric songs at the start of the set with my stories and my, you know, dark themes, and then the end of the set just played like all my kind of up-tempo rock and roll songs, and everyone like, you know, had a dance and stuff. It was awesome fun. And I came home, you know, Justin stayed home that weekend. I came home and I was like, oh my God, it was the best. But I really wish he was there to see me like do the thing, you know.
Yeah.
But it was a good time. So I think, it's like anything, I'd just really like to improve, you know, my skills over time and work on my playing. I think, you know, to be honest, I think, you know, what I do on guitar has always been, you know, very heavily centered around what the songs that I play require, you know. So I'm sort of inclined to learn things or to develop skills that go with the songs and stuff like that. So, you know, I would like to have an excuse to branch out a little bit more, but I guess we'll just see where it all goes in the future.
It's always good to take a little trip outside the comfort zone.
It's a never-ending journey.
Until it is your comfort zone, and you take a trip to another place outside your comfort zone.
That's right.
And hence the journey of self-improvement and discovery goes. Okay, so you've got a little cover for us for our We Learn and Still Learn segment. And what do you have for us?
This song is, I played it a few times in my set, actually. I don't like to do covers, for the reasons I sort of stated, talked to you about previously. I think it's really easy to default to playing covers sometimes when you're at gigs, and, you know, sometimes you have that thing, oh, I want to play a song that people know, or I want to get people on side by playing something that they know. And I've really tried really hard to steer away from that sort of thing. But I guess in the last couple of years, I found myself you know, if I'm doing long gigs, wanting to share some songs that I love with people that are written by, you know, more kind of obscure songwriters, you know, people I really respect.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this song I'm going to play for you, it's called They Don't Let the Girls in the Game, and it's by an Australian songwriter by the name of Michael Waugh. He's originally from southeast Gippsland, mm-hmm. And now resides in Melbourne. And Michael has a really beautiful way of telling Australian stories.
Love
in
it.
Songs. And I just, you know, the first time I saw Michael play was at Newstead Folk Festival in Victoria. And I don't even remember what point I walked in on his set, but I was in tears for like the entire gig, because he just chooses some really powerful subject matter and has such a disarming and commanding way of telling a story and making you empathize with the characters. And yeah, he was, you know, a really big influence on a couple of songs that I wrote for my last record, where I just thought, oh man, like just to be able to draw people into a story and a character. And I guess it's a really powerful thing, you know, if you hear a story about somebody who doesn't come from the same background as you, doesn't share any of the same experiences, but you find yourself, you know, being in their shoes and empathizing with their position, it's a really powerful
Absolutely. It's a really powerful tool. Very, very powerful tool. Yeah. Yes, I agree. So what was the song called again, sorry?
It's called They Don't Let the Girls in the Game.
Lovely.
Little plastic whistle blows, someone broke the rules. You gotta teach them young where the lines are drawn if they're gonna be taught at all. Standing on the boundary line, waiting for the bounce of the ball, hoping for a chance to kick it back in if it gets knocked out on the full. The best footy player in all of grade 3 is a little blonde kid named Marie. She finally gets a shot, everyone's impressed. She kicks it pretty far, she kicks it in her dress, and everybody loses when we all don't get to play. Some run around on the oval, but they don't let the girls in the game. They don't let the girls in the game. The full forward's full of praise. He says you kick well for a girl. And he says if you like, you can watch at the side and help us keep and score. Then the teacher from yard duty comes, sends Marie back to the girls. She says the boys on the oval play too rough. If you hang around here, you'll get hurt. So she climbs to the top of the monkey bars and she watches the game from the slide. While the girls on the asphalt play with their swap cards, Marie dreams of freedoms away from the tampon. Everybody loses when we all don't get to play. Some run around on the oval, but they don't let the girls in the game. They don't let the girls in the game. Down amongst the cypress trees, playing Doctor Who, a little weird kid who wants a time machine to take him to when lunch is through. Breaking in through the branches, flying in through space. Someone kicks the Sharon and it crash lands on his face. They say, kick it back here, loser. But the loser's afraid of the ball. So they call him all the worst of the names they can call, and everybody laughs when they say he's a girl. 'Cause they don't let
with the girls in the game. Some of us were left on slides, some were left in trees. Some of us were girly boys, some were girls just like Marie. When will we not be losers? When will we get to play? When will we all grow up from grade three when they don't let the girls in the game? They don't let the girls in the game. They don't let the girls in the game. And they don't let the girls in the, they don't let the girls in the game. They don't let the girls in the, they don't let the girls in the game. They don't let the girls in the, they don't let the girls in the game. They don't let the girls in the, they don't let the girls in the game.
Yes, that was fantastic. Oh my God, I actually had no idea it was actually going to be about football.
Yeah.
That is a subject very dear to my heart. So for our overseas listeners, the national sport, the most popular sport in Australia, is Australian rules football. But until very recently, women were only allowed to play until a certain level. And even then, it was seen as a little bit of an oddity, I think.
Yeah.
Until like 3 years ago, well, we're in the third season now, the AFLW was started. And I think regardless of whether you have any interest in football or not, I think it's a, I think it's a massive revolution. I think it's so wonderful.
I think it's – I mean, it's really important, you know, like growing up being female, you know, if – playing sport is something that you really want to do. Like when you're a kid, so much of, you know, how you know what's possible for you is by seeing people do it. And, you know, you just know, like it's not necessarily like a conscious realization, but as a young person, if you can't see anybody that you identify with or that looks like you doing what you want to do, I mean, sport is a very obvious and blatant kind of – you know, women are really underrepresented and, you know, not that just because I guess there aren't the opportunities. And I think there's, you know, obviously a massive disparity in, what women get paid to play, in many different, sports, you know. I mean, I think the Australian, football team, the soccer team, it's like way more successful than the men's team. And same with the Australian women's cricket team. It's like super successful. Where's the money? You know, yeah, that's right. And I really think it's about, you know, it's really just about networks going, yeah, we're going to air this. We're going to put it on TV. And that's where the fans come from, you know, like broadcast television and giving it a platform, you know. And it's pretty upsetting. You know, you hear those, you know, famous stories about women in the Australian soccer team who, you know, were, you know, came straight out of high school, went into playing soccer. You know, they could only do it like quote unquote part-time because it didn't pay a full-time wage. So that, you know, a lot of them didn't go to university because they were just dedicated to their craft, dedicated to their sport, you know, playing footy and then, you know, working in low paid jobs. And it's just, and it's outrageous, you know, when you see that pay gap, you know. And I think it's just great to see that sort of inequality being talked about. And, you know, other areas where women are really underrepresented, like politics and, you know, in the sort of the upper areas of, you know, corporate governance and that kind of thing, you know. There's totally a reason for that. And I think it, you know, it really starts, I think, with kids at school and their attitudes to the opposite gender. And, you know, kids get that from home. They get it from the media. I mean, having said that, even if you grow up in a really kind of, you know, progressive household, like kids still pick up,
there's so much that children learn from their environment that is unspoken, and I think a lot of, you know, racism and misogyny is learnt that way, you know. So, yeah, and, yeah, so I think it's, you know, it's great that we're kind of having these conversations, but, you know, I mean, years ago I remember I was hanging out with some friends and their son was, you know, really – really massive sports fanatic, you know, and he'd been a fan of like the Stilsons and stuff and for a long time. And, yeah. And like he, did, you know, young kid and just made this comment, like he said, yeah, boys are way better at sport than girls. And I was absolutely like, I mean, I guess so shocked to hear him say this because of the kind of family he grew up in, but also because, you know, it kind of took, it really took me like back to that spot of being a kid at primary school and having like boys like, you know, kind of put you down or try to rub it in your face or like exclude you as a way of kind of big noting themselves to their friends and that sort of thing. And, you know, school's a brutal place and you know, I think, you know, it's really easy to fall into that trap of picking on someone else so that you don't get picked on, you know, that sort of like pass it down the line so that you're not at the bottom of the, you know, the pecking order. But, yeah, I guess, yeah, there's a long way to go. And I think, you know, I feel like the education system's starting to take really positive steps towards addressing a lot of these, you know, huge kind of social issues. But there's such a long way to go because I think, you know, children really pick up on, you know, the difference between what adults say to do and what they actually do. And it's not necessarily, you know, I speak from my own personal experience, it's not necessarily a really conscious thought process for children, but they detect the hypocrisy of, well, this is what I'm being told to do, but this is what everyone does. This is what I'm being told is the right thing, but this is what everyone does, you know. And so,
which is what they mirror.
Absolutely, yeah, of course, that's right. Yeah, so yeah, I just think it's great that we're starting to talk about these kind of things, you know, and I feel
it
like
it's wonderful. Yeah. As you say, there's still a very long way to go. And the AFL are doing a lot of things to kind of fuck up the AFLW and hinder its progress. But the fact that it is existing now is a wonderful thing. It should have existed a long time ago. And there's many other examples of that. But little by little, I think things are getting better. Let's hope so, huh?
You know what I'm looking forward to? I'm looking forward to the day when we listen to the news and at the end of the news they have the sports section and then they have the arts section. Why not?
Yeah.
Where is that? Why not? Why not?
Absolutely.
The later, like, what's showing at the NGV? What? Who's touring Australia? Like,
I'd never thought of that before, but you're absolutely correct. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I look forward to that day too. Thank you so much for that contribution. So that was, just to clarify, that was Michael Waugh.
Michael Waugh.
I will drop some links to him in the show notes because I really, really enjoyed that. And I'd like some other people to hear more of his work. Thank you.
Thank you.
Kat, JB, thank you so much for being on episode 27 and putting me in heaven for more than a wheelin' in Reza. Live from Reza. We're not live, but we're coming at you from Reza.
Well, thanks for coming north.
It was quite an effort. I had to get a passport and everything.
The quinoa curtain.
The what? The quinoa curtain? I haven't heard that one before.
Yeah.
Hipster-proof fence. Wow. Yeah,
you're out in the Badlands now.
I am. I hope you're going to, like, give me a escort home. I'm a bit scared out here. What's going to happen to me?
Someone might offer you
It's part of the journey is the ride back home on your own.
Oh, yeah. That's true. That's true. It'll be a good experience. I'll record the whole thing. Document it.
Yeah, just text us when you get, to make sure you get
okay,
home.
Okay, right. I will. So tell me what's coming up in the world of Kat and JB.
We're actually doing a co-headline tour in May and early June. So we're doing some Victorian dates. So we're playing at Caravan Club in Bentley and Glen Iris is in Glen Iris in Melbourne. And then we're playing out in Pistol Pete's in Geelong. We're playing Mount Macedon Hotel in Mount Macedon and the Guildford Family Hotel.
Did you say co-headline? So who's that with? Well, you mean co-line with
together.
Each other?
Together,
oh,
yeah.
I see.
We're
right.
playing together.
Right. I love that. That's good.
Yes.
Yeah.
We love it too.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and we also have a show out in New South Wales in the middle of the year too, which would be really nice to get out of the Melbourne winter and get up to the New South Wales climate.
Yeah. So you've got a website for Mountain King Music. Is that correct?
Yeah, we both have individual
websites too. So I'll be dropping some links to those all over the place so people can catch up all that stuff. Thank you so much. And and you and I, JB, might even have something boiling away.
Yes, we've talked about it.
We're potentially working on.
That's right.
We're not going to totally pull the sheet off that yet, but I think a little collab is in the works there.
Definitely.
Yeah.
It's on record.
Very exciting.
We have screenshots in Facebook Messenger to prove it.
Right. Okay. committed now. Committed. Yes. Committed. And okay, so thank you so much.
Thank you.
For coming on to More Than the Wheel. It's been absolute pleasure. And we'll catch you guys around. Bye.
Bye.
See ya.
That awesome podcast was recorded at Castaway Studios in Collingwood. Here, we provide affordable, accessible, professional podcasting production facilities to the full range of podcasters, all the way from basic studio hire right through to full season production packages. You can get us on castawaycollingwood@gmail.com or just look up Castaway Studios on all the social medias.